a dirty town. Don't like living in a dirty town. I don't like living in a dirty town, 'cause a dirty town gets me down.
But in this heated atmosphere, even the totally innocent can get drawn in so quickly.
Because I think everyone's fed up with what's happened, really, with the world economy, and how little democracy there is, and how little say we actually have in how our taxes are spent. And... Hang on, there's a few scholars just going on there.
I bought some land, 'cause I can't stand living in a dirty town. Yeah, I pinch my pennies and I put them down, and I wash my hands of a dirty town.
The ancient streets of the city of London fill to the sounds of anger. It was predicted and promised by some. As thousands reached the Bank of England at its centre, it erupted. The Royal Bank of Scotland building fast turned into a symbolic target of the anti-capitalist demonstrators. It wasn't long before its windows were smashed.
First of all, we're in the middle of an economic collapse. This economic collapse has biophysical underpinnings. I believe that this economic collapse is at its base, at its roots, is an ecological collapse, and I will talk about why I believe that.
You have just heard rioting hit the central banks of London during the G20 conference, set to Dirty Town from Mother Mother. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. The world is quietly burning with discontent as corporate schemes go bad. Industry and trade are collapsing and no one seems immune. The World Trade Center has fallen again, and maybe the Pentagon will be next. I've had some long hours into the night worrying. How about you? We have two guest speakers this week to help you engage. Even though I realize everyone is gobsmacked by crumbling banks and revelations of piracy at the top, we just can't take our eyes off our natural life support system. Ice is cracking loose at the poles, you know that. In desperation, President Obama's new science advisor, Dr. John Holdren, a man who I do respect, he joins a chorus of experts toying with the idea of cooling off the atmosphere by artificial means. We'll hear a top National Oceans and Atmospheric Administration scientist explain there's a huge risk to human geoengineering. In fact, Dr. Richard Feely has a horror story of his own to tell. Our carbon waste is turning the oceans acidic. Well, so what? The whole marine food chain is threatened. I'll bet the G20 didn't discuss our dying oceans for even 20 seconds. Banks come first.
A little bit of trouble in the background by the looks of it.
Then we'll go to a recent speech by Greenpeace founder, author, and peak oil expert Rex Weiler. We've gathered up a powerful half-hour segment connecting the dots between the economic collapse and dying natural systems. Rex even throws in a few suggestions on how we can cope. That's coming up in our second half-hour of Radio EcoShock. Getting back to the riots in Europe, and likely soon enough in North America, is it worth trying to protest the rape of our jobs, savings, and pensions? It's time to turn to the stimulator.
I'd like to say thank you to the United Kingdom government for bailing out the bankers, for socialism for the rich, for passing on the cost of capitalism to the poor. And we'd like to say 2, 4, 6, 8. We like marching 2, 4, 6, 8. Capital must accumulate.
Still must accumulate.
It's the end of the world as we know it.
Good morning, slaves, and welcome to another edition of It's the End of the World as We Know It and I Feel Fine. I am your host, The Stimulator, and the Summer of Rage got an early start. The UK and France have been buzzing with exciting riotous activity. Let's begin with the French.
Europe is attractive because of its people, so marketing.
It's that European creativity that got his ass kidnapped. The time-honored tradition of boss snapping is back in vogue since factories are closing left and right. Sony Europe CEO Serge Fokker was just the latest victim. Yep, Mr. Fokker was held against his will overnight by pissed-off factory workers who were unsatisfied with their severance packages after it was announced that their factory was going to be closed. Other recent boss snappings in France include four managers at Caterpillar, Luc Rousselet, director at 3M, and two bosses at a Michelin factory. Execs at the now-closed Continental Tire factory escaped in the nick of time, probably because they knew they had been flagged for future boss snapping.
Oh, snap!
Taking over factories is fashionable again. Several Ford factories in the UK have been occupied, and workers are demanding that the US car maker honor their contracts. In the heart of the British Empire, the 20 gangsters of the industrialized world convened to figure out how to spend your dollars. About a trillion of them. A few of my viewers have wondered if protests are a total waste of time. After all, in February of 2003, the largest mass demonstration in the world took place in opposition to the Iraq War. But to answer your question, if you have not been to a massive convergence, you're just going to have to find out for yourself. On a personal level, these events connect me with some badass motherfuckers who are dedicating their lives to revolution. In this world of instant tweeting communications, many feel that posting links and information is their form of activism. Protests take you out of your Facebook group comfort and in contact with real people and, well, real pigs. Your body adds to the numbers of peeps acting in the real world to reclaim what is rightfully ours, our public space. It's a simple act of defiance to those who'd rather see you rot in fear on your living room lazy boy while watching American Idol. Note, protests are not the be-all end-all of activism, but they act as a classroom to those getting their feet wet in the resistance, and for others it serves as fuel for inspiration. And hey, like in Seattle and in Prague, sometimes we win.
Get the full video of that and dozens of other pro-level reports from the Stimulator at Submedia TV. Warning to college students, the site contains adult language. You know, the way you actually talk to one another. All this talk of social upheaval and transformation is exciting, I know. Next week, we'll devote a full hour to zombie banks feeding on the flesh of taxpayers and the newly homeless, all with a special guest.
Ladies and gentlemen, we interrupt our program of dance music to bring you a special bulletin from the Intercontinental Radio News.
Could a supposedly intelligent species make the world's oceans more acidic? It sounds like science fiction, but now it is science. Our guest is Dr. Richard A. Feeley, an oceanographer at the NOAA Pacific Marine Laboratory in Seattle and a fellow of the American Geophysical Union. He specializes in the way carbon cycles in the sea and ocean acidification. Welcome, Dr. Feeley, and thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me on your show.
Well, ocean acidification, it doesn't sound easy to describe to a stranger on the street. Could you take a shot at a short description of the problem for us?
Sure, I'd love to. As we burn coal and oil and natural gas and gasoline for fuel and energy, all that carbon dioxide is released into the atmosphere. And over the past 200 years or so, we've released somewhere in the neighborhood of about 540 billion metric tons of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And about a third of that has been taken up by the oceans. And since carbon dioxide is a gas that immediately reacts with the water of seawater, it forms a weak acid called carbonic acid. And carbonic acid quickly dissociates and releases a hydrodyne, which gives the oceans its acidity. And this increase in the carbonic acid over that amount of time has increased the acidity of the ocean by about 30% over the last 200 years. And with the projections of the use of fossil fuel in the future, using the IPC scenarios for the business as usual, we could see increases of acidity as much as 150% by the end of this century. And that's what's causing the concerns of the marine scientists about the impacts of this changing acidity on the ocean biota.
It sounds to me like a huge uncontrolled chemistry experiment. Eventually that could have a big impact, but is ocean acidification already happening?
Oh yes, we have actually been able to measure the changes that have taken place in seawater. I spent most of my career studying these changes, And we have the measurement capability to actually see these changes over time, and we have been doing so throughout most of the world oceans. And they are quite significant throughout my career of the past 20 years or so. We've seen changes of pH as much as about 0.04 pH units over that time frame alone. Basically a 6% change in the acidity over the last 15 years. So these are measurable changes that we can see, and some recent papers have suggested that they're starting to have some very significant impacts on marine organisms. Now, since carbonic acid's a weak acid, one of the first things it does, it tends to combine with a species called carbonate ion. And carbonate ion is one of the building blocks for calcium carbonate-forming organisms, such as snails and shelled organisms, such as lobsters and abalone and oysters. And as the concentration of carbonate ion decreases, and it's already decreased about 16% since the pre-industrial period, it's more difficult for them to produce their shells and skeletons, and they tend to become thinner and they grow more slowly. Well, for a coral reef organism, for example, which makes its entire skeleton out of calcium carbonate, growing slowly is a difficult problem for them because they have to continue to grow at a fast rate in order to grow and keep up with sea level rise. And so if they tend to slow down, as we're seeing over the last 15 years that they are slowing down, then they have a problem maintaining their livelihood and their coral structures and keeping up with sea level rise. That's one example. Other species like foraminifera and pteropods, which are marine snails that live in the water column, their shells are beginning to become thinner and more brittle, and they can begin to break apart very quickly. We're seeing evidence of that occurring in the high northern and high southern latitudes right now.
Well, you've mentioned these very tiny shell forming. I guess, are they plankton, really?
Yes. They pteropods, for example, are real small, tiny snail-like creatures. They're about as big as the size of your baby fingernail. You can see them with your naked eye. The foot of the snail has been modified into a swimming structure, and they swim quite well with the foot, and they tend to stay deep in the water column during the day to avoid predation by fish, and then they come up to the night to feed. And these pteropods, for example, are primary food sources for juvenile salmon and pollock and other species that are of particular importance to the United States fisheries. And in fact, this pink salmon in particular, that's 60% of the diet of the juvenile pink salmon in the wintertime. And these pteropods are very, very sensitive to changes. When they get into the corrosive waters that can exist in our high northern latitudes, the shells begin to dissolve within 48 hours.
Wow, so it's affecting things further up the food chain. And I've also been told that these very tiny creatures may grab anywhere from 25 to 50% of the carbon from the ocean, so they may be important agents of climate control here on Earth. Am I getting that picture correctly?
Well, I haven't heard those numbers before, so I can't verify that particular estimate. That seems high to me. Basically, we consider there's two processes by which carbon dioxide are removed from the surface ocean. One is by the biology, as you just mentioned, and the other is by the ventilation, that is the circulation between the surface ocean and the deeper oceans. And both those processes are important. And so any changes to the biology, we can affect that capability, that feedback mechanism for carbon being released from the ocean back to the atmosphere. So that's a very serious concern that the modelers are working with right now, is how these feedback mechanisms will work in a high CO2 world.
I've also read in a journal, Nature Geoscience, a Tasmanian report about this same problem happening in the southern oceans. So it's not something, though, that's just happening far away. You've been doing some research here in North America?
Yes. Well, this is a global problem. It happens everywhere. More CO2 tends to go into the oceans at high latitudes because CO2 is more soluble the colder the water is. So there is significant concern about what's happening in the Arctic and in the Antarctic regions. And in fact, those regions would be considered to be the regions where corrosive waters might reach the surface first. But what we found is off the coast of Washington, Oregon, and California, there's another return mechanism where the ocean acidified waters gets returned to the coast. And this is a process called upwelling. And what happens there is that along our coast, the winds shift to the north to come from the northwest in the summertime. And when that happens, the surface waters are pushed offshore, and the subsurface waters are pulled on the shore. And the subsurface waters come from a depth about 150 to 200 meters. So they're essentially right at the shelf break, and then they get pulled all the way to the beach and all the way to the surface. And what we found was that these subsurface waters were enriched in anthropogenic CO2 and were corrosive to these calcium carbonate-forming species. And we found these waters actually reaching the surface off of Northern California. And this process occurs anywhere from April to September or October. And so we're seeing corrosive waters now when the models would have predicted that we wouldn't see them until the end of the century. So we have to take into account these additional processes of upwelling and how that might accelerate the impacts of ocean acidification.
Well, as always, nature is a bit more complex than we thought. We're talking with we're talking with ocean specialist Dr. Richard A. Feely. And Dr. Feely, I'd like to verge off just a little bit from this into the idea of geoengineering. We just had a project, the LOHFX project, where they tried to stimulate algae growth with iron and wasn't really that successful. But it seems to me almost all the geoengineering suggestions, whether it's blasting sulfates or seawater into the sky or throwing up deflecting mirrors, they don't deal with this problem that we're talking about of carbon going into the ocean more and more. I wonder if these alleged solutions are just going to dump more carbon into the sea.
Well, that's one of the concerns that we have with geoengineering that try to solve the temperature problem but don't deal with the major cause of global warming, which is the release of CO2 emissions into the atmosphere. And by addressing, say, the symptoms and not addressing the cause, we end up with higher CO2 levels in the atmosphere and therefore more severe problems for ocean acidification and the organisms that live in the oceans. And I think that a lot of us are very concerned that these geoengineering approaches don't take into account the ocean acidification issue, and they need to do so.
You know, I wonder if we asked 10 people in the street about ocean acidification, whether we'd find even one that's knew about it or was really concerned about it. It hasn't hit the world media the way the polar bears or some other signs of climate change have. There were scientists at the Copenhagen summit recently that brought this up, and they're saying that we're returning possibly to ocean conditions not seen since the time of the dinosaurs 65 million years ago. Is there a possibility this could lead to mass extinctions as happened then?
Well, there's a considerable difference in what we're doing now as compared with the processes that occurred 65 million years ago. For one thing, we're releasing CO2 in the atmosphere at a rate that's literally tens to 100 times faster than these geological processes that occurred in the past. And that's particularly important because that means that most of the CO2 still resides in the upper ocean. In fact, most of the anthropogenic CO2 resides in the upper 1,500 meters of the ocean right now. And it takes several hundred years for that anthropogenic CO2 to get to the bottom of the ocean and circulate. And that circulation problem is particularly important because the way you neutralize this anthropogenic CO2 is by reaction with the carbonate species, the dead shells in the bottom of the ocean. And then that neutralizes the CO2 and returns alkalinity to the seawater. But this process takes several circuits of the ocean and essentially thousands of years for it to occur. So if you release CO2 to the atmosphere very, very rapidly, the oceans do not have enough time to absorb all that CO2 and neutralize it by reaction with deep sea sediments. And this is how the oceans dealt with this problem in the past, is they basically had enough time to neutralize a lot of that CO2. And mankind really isn't allowing the oceans to do that, so it tends to build up in the surface ocean and basically can cause more severe problems over the next 200 years or so than what we experienced in the past. So the analogies are not perfect. We're stressing the oceans much more significantly than had occurred in the past. Nevertheless, if you look in the geological record and look at these past extinction events, what you find is that in each case, and there's five major extinction events that took place, each of those five major extinction events were associated with a major ocean acidification event as well. Their CO2 concentrations were many times higher than they are today. And associated with each of those extinction events was a tremendous loss of the calcium carbonate species, both coral reef species and in many cases, and sometimes some of the benthic species as well. And, for example, during the KT boundary 65 million years ago when the dinosaurs died, we lost about 95% of the coral reef species. And it took anywhere from 2 to 18 million years for them to re-evolve. And so the kinds of processes that would cause ocean acidification could cause a loss of many, many species of organisms in the sea. And it basically would be many millions of years before they would return in some form that's similar to what we experience on Earth now. So I guess that's one of the reasons why I'm so concerned about this problem, because the decisions that we make about CO2 emissions and the potential impacts of CO2 emissions could have far-reaching impacts on our ocean ecosystems for many hundreds of thousands to millions of years.
And scientists are raising the warning flag about ocean acidification. You have the Monaco Declaration released in January saying that acidification is accelerating and severe damages are imminent. Are you part of a group of scientists who are trying to get this message out?
Yes, I am. I was a co-signer of that declaration, and there are about two or three similar declarations that have taken place. That's the most noteworthy declaration. There's also a very recent movie, the documentary, a full-length documentary called A Sea Change that just was released last month in Washington, D.C. It's a wonderful documentary about ocean acidification. It's primarily geared at the layperson so they can understand it easily and understand the potential impacts of ocean acidification, and also gives us some solutions about what would happen if we chose to move towards alternative sources of energy and how we might do that. So it gives us a very positive and constructive means of thinking about how we might consider our energy choices of the future.
Well, who put out the video Sea Change, and how could we find it?
It was put out by Barbara Ettinger and Sven Husaby of Niji Films. And if you just Google A Sea Change, it will come right up.
All right. And do you have other suggestions on what listeners could do to find out more about ocean acidification?
Yes. If you go to my webpage at Pacific Marine Environmental Laboratory, so it's pmel.noaa.gov, and you look on the front page for ocean acidification, I have all sorts of useful information and research reports and documentaries and some videos.
Is there anything we've missed or a message that you'd like to add at this time?
Just as I said towards the end of my conversation, is that we're really at a turning point as humankind. If we continue to burn fossil fuel for oil and from oil and gas and for energy, then we will be continuing to release CO2 in the atmosphere at a rate that many of our marine ecosystems cannot respond to, and it's our concern that the changes could be quite dramatic and have significant impact on our food resources from the sea and many of the population of the island nations throughout the world are directly dependent on these food resources. Approximately a third of the population of the world depends on food resources from sea for as much as 25% of their protein resources. So this is a very important security issue in terms of food security for our population. And I think we need to take serious concern about what we're doing with our ocean ecosystems.
We've been chatting with Dr. Richard A. Feeley from the NOAA Pacific Marine Environmental Laboratory in Seattle. Dr. Feeley, thank you for spending your valuable time with us.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, I'm Alex Smith reporting for Radio EcoShock. Broadcast on 16 stations in Canada and the United States. Going out over the world by satellite and cable, podcast and downloads, you've got Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Get tons of free MP3 downloads from our site at ecoshock.org. ECO, shock like an electric shock. It's radioactive.
Wondering aloud, will the years treat us well?
Ah, a moment from Jethro Tull. Our next speaker, Rex Weiler, is one of the original Greenpeace gang, author of Greenpeace The Inside Story, plus two more books, and a recurring journalist in all media. He's also a Peak Oil spokesman, recorded in the Radio EcoShock show Peak Oil and the Media, broadcast August 29, 2008, and available free from our archive. Rex sees the links between degrading the Earth and our economic collapse. His insight is well worth our time. Here is 30 key minutes from Rex Weiler's speech to the BioSociety Conference at McMaster University in Canada on March 20, 2009.
First of all, we're in the middle of an economic collapse. This economic collapse has biophysical underpinnings. I believe that this economic collapse is at its base, at its roots, is an ecological collapse, and I will talk about why I believe that. And one thing I've noticed with all the speakers today, and myself included, is that we all want to be positive, we all want to be optimistic and make you feel better, and yet a lot of the data and a lot of the information that we're bringing to you is very troubling. We were talking about this this morning on our way in here about always trying to be optimistic, and sometimes, you know, I want to say, I think first and foremost, we're at a university where we want the facts, we want the data, we want the information. So first of all, we want realism. And I think that without realism, our optimism can be delusional. And we want to avoid false solutions and delusion. So we'll start with realism. One of the things, back in the 50s, in the 1950s, Paul Sears made the comment that ecology was going to prove to be the subversive subject, the subversive science. And I think that we believe this in the 1970s when Greenpeace was started, and the reason it's going to be the subversive science, it's going to undercut everything else we do. Because throughout human history, we have kind of developed this concept and this idea that we are masters of our environment. And what we're going to learn through ecology is that we're not masters of our environment at all. We are, in fact, embedded in a biophysical system, and that we're going to have to learn from it. We're not just going to whip it into shape or manage it. One of these concepts of having a new perspective, I seriously believe that humanity, and each of us as individuals, we have to go through a paradigm shift of really unprecedented proportions. Certainly as profound as the paradigm shift in the 16th century when Copernicus and then later Kepler and Galileo pointed out that the whole universe may not be going around us, that in fact we may be orbiting the sun,
at the time, you have to understand, in the 16th century, this was a profound idea, and people had a very hard time getting it through their heads that this might be possible. And I think that we're going to have to get a similar paradigm shift in our time. And just as Copernicus showed that we're not the center of the universe, I think ecology is going to show us that we're not the center of life on the planet, and the rest of the life on the planet does not revolve around our needs. Between 1990 and now, we have blown past our carrying capacity. According to calculations by Bill Reeset, the University of British Columbia, who developed the ecological footprint concept, we're into 30% overshoot already. Humanity is using 30% more stuff. Now, I told you we were going to do the realism part first. We'll get to the optimism part second. What we were talking about earlier when we were on our way in here was bring your own optimism. I'm going to give you the data as I understand it. I'm not trying to be optimistic or pessimistic. I'm trying to be realistic. So bring your own optimism to this. But I do have some ideas, my own ideas, and I stay optimistic too. I try to keep a sense of humor about it too. As my friend Wavy Gravy says, without a sense of humor, it's just not funny anymore. Okay, so 30% overshoot. So when we're here, we want to know about the future. So in order to see the future, we're going to back this graph up. So here we are now. There's our total throughput. That's all the stuff we've ever used, the yellow part of that graph, the area under the curve. Now, we've lowered the carrying capacity of the planet, and we've blown past it. Now, does anybody think we can keep going there at 3.5% growth? How about 1%? What if we do an unprecedented... We talk about innovation and efficiencies. What if we have an unprecedented innovation over the next 20 years or next 30 years in which we actually reduce our throughput per unit of GDP from 3.5% to 1%? It's never been done before, not even remotely close. Our throughput pretty much tracks our population growth and our GDP. So let's say we do have this massive, innovative, technological renaissance in which we actually create all these efficiencies. Even at 1% growth, we're still going to double, divided into 70, 1 into 70 is 70, we're going to double our throughput in 70 years. Here's what that looks like. You don't even have to do the calculus. You can just look at that, and you can tell as well as I can. That area under the new curve between now and 70 years from now in 2080 is more than twice all the stuff humanity has ever used. We're halfway through the forest. We're 90% through some fish species. We're 95% through the marine mammals. We're halfway through the oil, the easy-to-get oil. We've used up the cheap oil. We've used up all the high net energy oil. We high graded everything. So when we say we're halfway through the forest in acreage, in hectares, we're halfway through the forest, but we high graded that forest. And we've high graded the oil, we've high graded the natural gas, and we've high graded the soils and everything else that we've used. And we've driven the carrying capacity down. So if we keep doing this for another 70 years to 2080, we're not going to be 30% into overshoot. We're going to be 300% into overshoot. That's two orders of magnitude, an order of magnitude higher percentage of overshoot. I call this the Wile E. Coyote moment. When I was little, we used to watch these cartoons. I don't know if you're probably more sophisticated than we were back then, but we love these Wile E. Coyote cartoons. And Wile E. Coyote always ran off the edge of the cliff and then looked around and realized there was nothing under him. And we thought that was so funny. Well, here's the problem. Is that all these growth scenarios, so we talk about sustainable growth. Well, sustainable growth is an oxymoron. Now, sustainable development is conceivable if you talk about qualitative development. But growth, we know, in a biophysical system, remember the fruit flies, right? Remember the bacteria in the petri dish, mussels on the seashore, remember the reindeer. In any biophysical system, there's a limit. And that all growth in a biophysical, or as Albert Bartlett says, if you want to learn about growth, Google Albert Bartlett and look at his videos about exponential growth. You'll learn what you need to know about growth. But here's something that Dr. Albert Bartlett says. He's from the University of Colorado near my hometown in Colorado. He says this: all growth after maturity is either obesity or cancer. Is that not true? Yes, it's true. All growth after maturity is either obesity or cancer. And the further we run out, the further we run out on these growth scenarios, believing that we're going to create some groovy innovation that's going to save us, we're only setting ourselves up for a crash. And that's why I'm saying that the economic crash that we're experiencing right now is in fact an environmental crash. We grew up in a forest. That's how we evolved. We need to take a step back. And we need to look at this and look at the miracle of our lives. Look at the miracle of nature. Learn how nature works. But now we're the meteorite. And the question is, we've gone in a couple of million years, we've gone from Homo erectus there with his spear to this nice couple. But we've initiated this next extinction period. And the question is, how far down can we drive it? And was there some carrying capacity that it was bumping up against there? We don't really know. But what we do know is that, after every crash, it came back. It came roaring back. Life will come roaring back, even after us, no matter what we do. So the issue we face isn't that we're going to destroy the planet or destroy life on the planet. It's that we are destroying our ability to live the life that we've come to know on the planet. So here we are back at our Wile E. Coyote moment. Now, my point is, we have to approach this from the other direction. Rather than little innovations that are going to make us, we often hear the expression, more sustainable. What does more sustainable mean? Well, we sort of know what that means. It means a little bit closer to sustainable. But if you're not sustainable, you're not sustainable. Does more sustainable mean you can cling on a little longer? Is that what that means? We either discover sustainability or we don't. And what we need to do, what we need to focus on is actually recovering this carrying capacity. When we talk about healing the planet, we're talking about recovering the lost carrying capacity. Now, is that doable? Yeah, that's doable. But it's not about building Priuses. It's going to take much more than that. We need to find a level of consumption below the carrying capacity. There's only one way to get this back on track. It's to consume less stuff. Now, this looks dramatic, like, oh my God, like, we're not talking about a drop between 3.5% and 1% of throughput. We're talking about less throughput, less stuff. And we're talking about a dramatically less amount of stuff. Now, here's a message no one wants to deliver. I don't want to deliver it. I don't want to be standing here in front of you telling you that we all have to use 50% or 90% less stuff. I don't want to tell my own children that we have to use less stuff, that in their lifetime they're going to have to use half the stuff I've enjoyed in my lifetime. And I can certainly tell you there's not a politician on the planet that wants to deliver this message, and no newspaper or magazine wants to deliver this message because they make a living selling stuff. And every corporation, every company in the world makes money by selling you stuff. So how are we going to do this? And this is why I think it's true. We need a religious paradigm. We need a new vision. We need a new sense of morality. And we need a whole new vision of who we are. That we're not going to sort of baby step our way into this. We're going to have some, we need a dramatic shift. Now, I grew up in a time, I went to high school in a little town in West Texas that was segregated. I went to a white high school. Now, imagine that. Whites in one school, blacks in the other. And this was before women's rights as well. And I can tell you, I grew up in a very patriarchal society when young women did not have the opportunities that you have. And those things changed. We changed those things. But we changed them by people standing up and making a stand and saying that they will not tolerate the old way anymore. And that's going to take the same thing. that here's where my optimism comes from. And I'm actually a very optimistic person. I have my own children, and I talk to them about this all the time. And I do not hide from them the reality that we're in. And I tell them, you have to be part of a major change in human understanding of who we are. And it's about using less stuff. I'm here with my friend Andrea from Toronto. She unplugged her fridge several years ago. She lives without a fridge. Now, maybe that's just a start, but that's the direction we have to go. Everything I'm wearing, everything I've worn for the last 2 decades is recycled. We do all of our shopping at the secondhand store. We do not buy new stuff. Our entire home, we live in a nice home, we have comfortable chairs to sit in, we have a nice dining room table, it's all secondhand. We live off the waste stream of our community.
You're listening to author and activist Rex Wyler on Radio EcoShock.
So here's my one suggestion, you know, make environmental responsibility your fashion statement. Don't buy new stuff. And I know a lot of people have been picking on cell phones today. And maybe cell phones are okay, but buying a new cell phone every couple of years and upgrading everything in every couple of years, that's not okay. Buy stuff that will endure. And your identity of who you are is not about how much stuff you have. And we have to get this through our heads. And if the rich 20%, which includes everybody in this room, the rich 20% on the planet are using 80% of the stuff, go figure it out. And if we're at 30% overshoot already, and the rich 20% are using 80% of the stuff, and we want ecology and social justice on the planet, do the math. We're going to have to, for starters, we're not going to ask the poor 80% who are barely making it to give up what they're consuming. We're the ones that are going to have to give it up just to get back to from 130% of the throughput of the carrying capacity down to 100%, and be nice to be below that. So for starters, we have to give up probably 40% of our stuff, of our throughput. Now, this does not mean we cannot have a higher quality of life. And this is the important thing. But we have to find this soft landing, this last little line here. This is my indication of if we can find a soft landing into less stuff. Now, by the way, this less consumption is only like 1970s level of throughput. You know, people say, well, we can't go back to the Stone Age. Well, newsflash here, this is not the Stone Age we're talking about. This is just ending our wasteful lifestyle and all our throwaway stuff and all our garbage. We have to get to zero garbage. In nature, there's zero garbage. I think that was said a couple of times today. There's no waste in nature. In nature, everything's recycled. So we got to do the same thing. We do have to mimic nature. If we don't, we learn the Wile E. Coyote gravity lesson. We crash. Just like every other species, just like the reindeer on St. Matthew's Island, just like the fruit flies, just like the people on Easter Island, if we think we can blow past our carrying capacity and just keep going and keep making our stone statues, we will crash. And this is why I say the economic crash we're experiencing right now, at its base, at its roots, it's an ecological crash. We have met the limits. Human society, in its aggregate consumption, has met the limits of the planet. And there's not going to be a recovery like in the 30s. They talk about everybody wants to stimulate the economy. What do they want to stimulate it to? Back up to 3% growth, 4% global growth? Won't happen. It's not going to happen. We got to find that magic place below the carrying capacity. And that we need to put every bit of our focus on finding that. If you were a space visitor on planet Earth, or if you had been able to go to Easter Island when they were zooming up and they were building all the stone statues and they hadn't crashed yet, what would you tell them? What would a space visitor coming to Earth tell us? They'd say, hey, humanity, like, you got a very cool thing happening here. You're really smart. You got a lot of things figured out, but you got to use less stuff. You can't just think you can just blow past your carrying capacity and that somehow you're different than the fruit flies or you're different than the reindeer. You need to learn that lesson, and this is the lesson we have to learn. And this is why I say it's a dramatic lesson, because there's nobody in our culture that wants to deliver the message. Our politicians don't want to deliver it. Our media don't want to deliver it. And we don't want to deliver it. We're all somehow hooked into this. We're all invested. And yet it's the reality that we have to face. These people are sustainable. They just need a forest. Give them a forest, they're fine. They don't need the rest of us. They don't need our part. Well, you can see they got our recycled t-shirts. How about these people? They have never, these are people in Brazil, they have never contacted modern human society. These people are sustainable. They just need the forest. That's all they need. Leave them alone. They're fine. Now, they don't have all the cool things we have. They don't have video games. They have nature, though. Their children grow up in nature. Their children grow up in the forest. This is a shot from a helicopter. You can see they're trying to shoot down the helicopter with their bows. I think that's pretty cool. What about these people? Is this sustainable? I don't know, maybe. I have a suspicion that that civilization is going to meet the Amish on the way back down the backside of the consumption curve. And the Amish are going to say, hello. But my point isn't that we all have to be farmers or we don't have to be Amish. We just have to use less stuff, and we can have rich lives. That happiness is not about consumption. Happiness is not about stuff. Happiness is about creativity. It's about being with our friends. It's about having a family. It's about having someone who cares for you. It's about having friends. Happy people are people who have someone that cares about them. It's really simple. And as we chase more stuff and we get more alienated from each other, we don't discover happiness. This is my nephew on his goat farm. Now, I'm not saying we all have to be hippies and grow dreadlocks and be farmers, but these guys have a decent life. They have a really nice life. They work hard. They work hard 7 days a week. They get up every morning. They milk the goats. They work hard. They grow their food. They work in the garden. They grow almost all the food they eat, and they sell their goat milk and they buy and goat cheese, and they buy a bit of stuff with it. And they work really hard, but they have a nice life, and they're happy, and they're satisfied. And I would never say to my nephew, oh, too bad you started that goat farm instead of getting your university degree and getting a job at some corporation and making $200,000 a year. He has a nice life. And these are my sons. It's Jonah and Liam with the goats there. And they go to work on the farm. It's the happiest time of their lives. So what we're talking about here is the quality of our lives. We're not talking about reducing quality of our lives. And we don't all have to be hippies or Amish and farmers. We just have to live simpler lives and realize that happiness isn't about stuff. Happiness is about having friends and family and some creativity. The Gucci bag isn't happiness. The Gucci swimsuit is not happiness. Happiness is having people around you who love you and who will care for you. These gamblers, their culture is going to crash. It's not sustainable. This kid on the horse here, his culture might be sustainable. There's a nice community garden. This is what we need to do. We just need to simplify. And in urban populations and urban centers, we just need to simplify and be reasonable and be smart about it. We need to remember where we come from. We need to learn and remember what it is that keeps us alive. It's the biosphere that keeps us alive. Now, I'm going to flash this up here because the last thing I thought was, I'm going to make a list of things we should do. And I started making the list. It's endless, the list of things we should do. But here's some of them. We should eliminate cars and build public transportation, at the very least. If we're going to survive, we're going to survive with public transportation. The car culture is over. And it was a mistake. It was a bad idea when it was started. And by the way, you know why we all drive cars in North America? Not because it was a consumer choice. It was a choice by General Motors, Standard Oil, and Firestone Tires in the 1930s formed a company called National City Lines, and they bought up every light rail public transportation system in North America. In Canada, they couldn't buy them, so they just came up here and they bribed city councils with free Cadillacs, and they ripped up the tracks. It wasn't a consumer decision to turn North America into a car culture. It was a corporate decision to turn America and Canada into car cultures. And they were successful. And they made a lot of money selling oil and tires and cars to human beings. When we could have had a really nice light rail public transportation system. I don't know how many of you have ever lived in Europe, but I've lived in Amsterdam and Zurich and other places, and it's no problem. You don't need a car. You walk out of your home. You walk down to the corner. You get on the streetcar. You go to the central station. You go to any address in Europe. And while you're traveling, by the way, you're reading a book or talking to friends or meeting new friends or having breakfast. And you're not sitting behind a wheel swearing at the other drivers. So we need to eliminate cars, build public transport. We need to convert the car space. 40% of our average city is space for cars, automobiles. Convert it all to food production, gardens. We need to stabilize and reduce human population. This is a topic that rarely comes up in international discussion. No one wants to bring it up. And someone said today, how do you reduce human population? It's very easy. Women's rights, first of all, globalize women's rights. Canada should refuse to do business with any nation that doesn't have equal rights for women. Because when women have the choice to how many children they want, they have less children. And if you make contraception available, they have way less children. So it doesn't take draconian government rules like the one-child policy. It just takes common sense. We have to reduce our CO2 emissions by 80%, and that's to keep the sea rise at 4 meters and not 7 or 8. Or if the whole thing melts, if all the ice on the planet melts, we're talking about 60 meters of sea rise, and that's adios, that's a brand new restart for civilization. 60-meter sea rise, it's a whole new... We'd be lucky if primates survive, but we probably will, but we need to avoid that. So the CO2 emissions that we need are dramatic. We have to reduce our throughput of matter and energy. We have to recycle everything 100%. We need new building codes, heat pumps, insulation, proper building codes. We need to preserve every square inch of farmland and forest. We need to preserve wilderness. We need to reduce our meat consumption. We need to be building dikes. We need to go up to the 2-meter level and start building dikes for another 2 meters, just to give our next generation a chance. We need global education, literacy building. We need to localize our communities. Our survival is now about resilience, because we are going to have global warming and we are going to have the sea rise. So what we need to do now is build strong communities that take care of each other. We're not this whole idea that we're all on our own and we're all, every individual for themselves. That's not going to work. What's going to survive are communities that are resilient. And finally, the last thing on this list is take care of each other. That's how we're going to make it happen. We're going to take care of each other. Here's the poet Mae Sarton, she says, you have to, now by the way, this is a long list, and this list isn't even comprehensive. There's many more things that need to go on this list. This is just a start. And it's overwhelming. It's overwhelming for me, so if you feel overwhelmed, please, it's okay. You should feel overwhelmed. I feel overwhelmed. And we're going to be slightly overwhelmed. We're already feeling slightly overwhelmed. The scientists that are meeting in Copenhagen right now as we speak are overwhelmed. They don't know what to do. The world leaders aren't listening to them. They've been saying this stuff for their entire careers, and no one's taking action. But you have to think like a hero. I love this from Mae Sarton. You have to think like a hero to behave like a normal, decent human being. Just to do the decent thing, you have to think like a hero. So when we think about all these things that we need to do, it just seems overwhelming. Just pick one. Pick one thing on this list and dedicate the rest of your life to it until it's solved in your community. And when you solve it in your community, see if you can solve it in your region. And when you can solve it in your region, you can use your experience to help solve it on the rest of the planet. Don't be overwhelmed. Just get active. I'll tell you, activism is the best thing that ever happened to me. I went to school as a scientist. I was going to be an aerospace scientist. I discovered ecology in university. I've been an environmental activist ever since, for 40 years. Activism is the best thing that ever happened to me, because at least I feel like I'm doing something. Every day of my life, I can look my kids in the face and I can say, it's going to be really bad, but it's not going to be really bad because I never did anything. It's going to be really hard, but we can do it. And the other thing is being active, and it doesn't mean you have to give up your careers. You can be whatever you want to be. You can finish your science degrees. You can get good jobs. You can do all kinds of things. But there has to be a part of your life which is helping to solve these problems. You have to think like a hero. But now, I'm not talking about a dramatic Hollywood hero. I'm talking about ordinary heroes, you and I, and Andrea, who unplugs her fridge, and our friends who give up their cars and just buy and recycle clothes instead of new clothes. Just do the common, decent thing, and that's heroic. My friend David Abram, who wrote a beautiful book called The Spell of the Sensuous, he says, sooner or later, technological civilization must accept the invitation of gravity and settle back into the land, the more-than-human world. It's a beautiful world. Nature is beautiful. Imagine discovering this planet. It's a beautiful place. And it's even going to be beautiful even when we're struggling to survive in a different way. It's still going to be beautiful. I have birds that come. I just love the birds outside my window. And you know, I feed the birds because I love to see them come. They give me so much pleasure, so much joy. Nature is very healing, and there's a lot of joy and pleasure in nature. Simple lives are going to be fine. And I'm not worried about my kids having to work hard for the rest of their lives. I'm not worried about them having to get up every morning and grow food and work hard. That's okay. I just want to avoid the crash as much as possible. Rilke says again and again, some people in the crowd wake up. They have no ground in the crowd, and they emerge according to much broader laws. They carry strange customs with them and demand room for bold gestures. The future speaks ruthlessly through them. That's us. That's you. You have to lead us. All the great changes in human history have been led by people like you and me, by citizens, by private citizens. Civil rights was not eliminated by governments. It was eliminated by people standing up and saying, we won't tolerate it anymore. Women's rights were brought into society, not by governments, not by corporations, by women standing up and saying, this is ridiculous and we won't take it anymore. That's the way all change happens. It's up to you. And Arne Naess, who founded the deep ecology movement, who just died recently, Norwegian philosopher, this sums it all up. Richer lives, simpler means. We don't need more stuff. We just need to be in nature, take care of each other, nurture our family, take care of our friends, nurture our friends, be nice to each other, that we can have much richer lives with less stuff. That's the good news. And that's what we can all do. We can all find those richer lives without having more stuff, without buying more stuff, without consuming more stuff. You know, this whole thing about buying a hybrid or buying an electric car, and I think you mentioned it when you were talking about your car. The most ecological thing you can do is keep whatever car you have and take care of it and repair it and keep it on the road. Trading in whatever car you have and buying a hybrid is not the ecological solution. The ecological solution is to repair and maintain whatever you already have. Because when you buy a new car, you're just creating more throughput, more stuff. Half the energy and all the materials that car will consume, it's already consumed when you buy it. Simpler means richer lives. That's the formula. That's our solution. And we can do it. You and I can do it. We can stand up and say, we're going to make this world different. And by the way, if we don't have any choice. We're going to get to sustainability either by our choices or by nature's choices. And let me tell you, Mother Nature is very patient and beautiful, but she's not sentimental. So if we want to find a soft landing into this sustainable life, we have to make those choices. And we can. We can do it. You can do it. Thank you very much.
That Rex Weiler speech comes from Maggie Hughes, producer of The Other Side of the News on 93.3 FM CFMU McMaster University Radio, which also broadcasts Radio EcoShock. Find Maggie's website at www.oside.ca. Get all these links from my blog entry for April 9th, 2009. You have been listening to the Radio EcoShock Show with me, Alex Smith. Find our website at ecoshock.org, and thank you again for caring about our world.
It's hot in the winter, even hotter in the summer. Jesus or Buddha, somebody come and help us out. Lord, come down and help us out. Send us an angel, help us out. SOS, help us out. I'm looking all around and I'm watching the world changing. Open up your eyes, you can see things rearranging. 'Cause baby, the world dying. And if they say it's gonna be alright, then people are lying.
The Black Eyed Peas, speak out.
When the Eskimo gets bit by a mosquito, somebody in Miami will get swept by a tsunami. Rosses in Jamaica will get hit by a quake that registered something like 7.8. You see, a situation's happening with our planet, 'cause 50 years ago we took it for granted. We should have took advantage and reversed the damage instead of just pumping and selling and slanging the gas. And while we purchased the gas, we was watching soap operas while they steady brainwashed the masses. 'Cause we could make a vehicle that runs off ashes, but they don't own a patent for that, and that's exactly what's happening. Corruption is bullshit politics. The planet's gonna die 'cause of bullshit politics. It's hot.